You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahi ahi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea tōku ingoa.
Ko Sophia tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. Kia ora mea, how are you this week?
I'm good, how are you? I heard about your football injuries.
I'm like injured from football, but it's okay, I'm alive, I'm here.
Yeah, she was trying to describe it to me, what a tournament was, and it did not go well.
we maybe know art, but we don't know sport here.
No.
Maya, what have we got on the show today?
Yeah, I caught up with Matthew Galloway about his current show, Watch History, which opened at Summa last night. So what have you got?
I had a kōrero with painter Hiria Anderson-Mita about Pā Te Huarahi Ki Te Kāinga, Finding My Way Home, currently on at Tim Melville Gallery.
He aha o whakara, we'd love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patahi mai, you can text us on 5395 5395-5395-5395 Waimairane, or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also, after the show, Koa e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō hei pakihere rokiroki maronga i te pai tuku tuku o Irirangi Pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website 95BFM.com.
What's it all for?
Various Artists.
Matthew Galloway is a Pōnaki-based artist known for his research-led practice in which he navigates his making through this design sensibility, examining the infrastructures within our everyday lives, producing socially engaged installations that include sculpture, prints, and video work. His current exhibition, Watch History at Summa, continues Galloway's approach to the world through this design landscape, producing an installation of over 70 engraved iPhone 16s on luxury modular couches, developed during his time at the McCann House Residency earlier this year. Over 70 iPhones engraved in fragments of text, taken from lines and closed captions from various films and TV shows that the artist watched, showcasing an unusually fixed screen with a watch history that removes itself from all context, media and human, creating a dynamic and at times absurd array of text in which the viewer encounters at their own pace and path of navigation. I caught up with Matthew about the show and overall practice.
Kia ora, my name's Matthew Galloway. My work is grounded, I guess, in a design sensibility. I started studying design at Ilam School of Fine Arts and have slowly gravitated into art spaces. And I guess for the last maybe decade or so, have primarily been making work in galleries alongside publications as well. And that design sensibility is important because I've come to really see the world as a designed landscape, like where everything that we interact with from the moment we wake up in the morning and look at our phones to how we get to work, the devices we use, the seats we sit on, like literally everything, are moments of design. And if you start to think of the world in that way, you start to be like, right, what dominant forms of design or ways of thinking have shaped the world? And what does it mean to then critique them in some way? So I have a show that a big, long project that looked at the Clyde Dam in central Otago, for instance, and how a hydro dam informs a lot of the ways we live. So it enables us to have electricity, it enables us to have internet, all of these things. But it also comes from this moment in the 1970s where our politicians were trying to figure out how to modernise the country and be less reliant on crazy swings and oil prices overseas. And so the minute you start looking at something like a dam, which is this stack of design, you start to be like, okay, this is the way the world is, and why is it like this, and how is the dam a window into critiquing that or thinking about it? Yeah, so I think in a nutshell, that's that idea of the design landscape is kind of what drives me a lot of the time.
Yeah, this like inherent architecture or something that's in our everyday lives that we participate in, but maybe never like rethink it or really engage with it in a certain way.
Yeah, a lot of these things just happen, and infrastructures are interesting because the whole idea of it is that we don't notice an infrastructure until it stops working.
And I'd like to start this conversation around your new work at Summa, Watch Histories, by speaking to its kind of beginnings, which unfolded during your time at the McCann Residency. What kind of questions, materials, or media did this project arise from?
This project is an interesting one for me. It's fun and it's loose, and I think in a way it's more immediate than some of my other projects. It started from this moment when I was watching something on my phone, like a TV series on Netflix. Mm. And I had the subtitles on and I saw the subtitle come up and it just, I liked it. I think it said something like, the past is never finished. And so I just screen grabbed it, kind of just second nature. But when I screen grabbed it, I found out that Netflix has this feature where it blocks you from actually screen grabbing the image, any of their content. And so it was a black image, but the subtitle was still there. So it was suddenly like this weird little decontextualized message, the past is never finished, in white at the bottom of the screen. And that just sat with me for a while. That was maybe, I don't know, a year or two ago. And a lot of my projects are like this. They dwell in the back of my mind and slowly find their way to the surface. If they kind of stay there long enough, I'm like, okay, this idea's not going away. But the idea that was, how can I present that subtitle as a work? And how can I do it in a way where it's not just a phone displaying it? Because I think there's nothing super interesting about that. And also I hate the idea that you have to have a phone plugged into work, and in the gallery setting, having power cords and everything. And I realized that I could engrave the subtitle into the phone. And there was a lot of trial and error. And this was happening while I was at the Macan. I started to play with the form and think, okay, can I print onto this glass? Can I, create a film over the top and paint on the film, like a clear film and stick it to the phone? And eventually I realized, that I could work with a trophy engraving center to laser engrave into the actual glass of the phone. And after that, I just started collecting heaps of these subtitles. And the final show is over 70 phones, each engraved with a different subtitle. And the phones themselves are not real iPhones. They're fake dummy iPhones that are basically shells. And so I think in that way, there's a lot of ways to read the work, but you could comment on the idea that these subtitles are taken out of context, but they represent my watch history, but the general idea of a watch history, that we all use these phones to ingest entertainment, but we also move on so quickly that we kind of forget.
Yeah.
We forget what we've watched. Yeah. We're on to the next thing. And these subtitles remain as like a little ghost of what we've watched. And the shell of the phone is maybe a comment on the emptiness of that as well. But I do enjoy the idea that there's lots of different ways people have been talking about and reading the work.
What I think is quite interesting is that, like, Netflix, I didn't only found this out today about that screenshotting and that blank screen. It automatically removes the text from its context.
Yeah.
It automatically makes that shift. And I think it's quite interesting you're building upon that. And also by engraving it, you're also, like, screens are these things that are, the image is always in flux. It's constantly moving. It's constantly shifting. But by engraving this text, you're kind of fixing it in that space to that phone. But I also wanted to speak a bit about these specific fragments of text themselves. Did you collect them over time? Because that first one just kind of happened. But then once you got that idea, were you more consciously screenshotting those texts?
Yeah, that was really interesting. And I went back and forth about how to do that because I didn't necessarily want every single one of them to have some grand meaning behind it. Like that first one, in a way, did because it started the whole process. And also the idea that, it was kind of a more philosophical one, the past is never finished. But then when I started to collect them, I realized that there was a lot of fun in the idea that some of them could seem meaningful and some could be really silly. Mm. And also closed captions became really interesting to me. So the idea of birds chirping, or there's one that says rain pattering, children playing. Mm-hmm. Which I really love. And so it becomes about, I became really aware of how entertainment film scripts are so economical with how they talk and do things. Like, you get a lot out of a very small amount of text. And even without any context, something like, there's one that says, like, officer, don't shoot. And it's, you get kind of like the genre, you kind of start to imagine what film that might have come from. And for a while, I also think having over 70 of them dilutes the importance of any which one being meaningful because they can all bounce off each other and do their own thing. But then, yeah, they're displayed as this massive group and it's overwhelming. But then also, if someone wants to buy one, I guess they can put it on their wall or display it in some way and it can be thought about a lot, just this one quote. So it operates in those two different ways.
Yeah, and by further removing them from their context, you kind of, yeah, create this new script and this new dialogue out of these fragments. Yeah, everyone that kind of walks through will have like a different, not story, but a different form of dialogue or a different form of words that they're interacting with as they pass through, kind of, yeah, creating their own orientation.
Yeah, and I have favourites, but I'm curious to find out which ones speak to other people. I like that idea that ones that I might not necessarily fully, that might not be my favourites might be someone else's favourite.
And this, you kind of talked about it already, but this form of engraving, did you really like this aspect that it was a permanent fixture onto the screen itself?
Yeah, 100%. I thought that it made it quite valuable in a way. Like, engraving feels to me like because it's so permanent, it feels valuable in some way. Like, you engrave things that are meaningful, whether it be like a gravestone or a memorial or the side of a building or a trophy. These things all, feel like engraving is a sense of permanence and wanting to keep it that way. And again, because, as you said earlier really nicely, phones are usually so transient in the way that images come and go so quickly. The fact that you're doing that is like juxtaposing the whole purpose of what a phone's meant to do.
And it's, as you said, you instantly get reminded of those I don't know, luxury watches or also maybe like, yes, that element of luxury, but also that, you know, it's like you'd engrave something to give to a loved one or that really personal item. Yeah. So also it's fixing this text on, but it is also kind of making it really personal sense. It's bringing that into that space as this object that's passed along rather than just this factory kind of object.
Yeah, 100%. And I think even the idea that, I don't know, just to print it on, doesn't have the same value and also feels like it's much easier to replicate or create. You could print like 5 versions of it super quickly, whereas the engraving's a little bit more, as you say, personal.
And these phones are then placed on these luxury couches, creating this really interesting dialogue between luxury and the everyday. Could you speak a bit to the decision behind the incorporation of these specific sofas that are used in the show?
Yeah, sure. They're a system of modular couches from the 70s called the Camaleonda range, Italian luxury sofas that have been supplied to us by Matisse. So, it's a collaboration with Matisse, who's a furniture store. And the discussion around the type of couch was actually a very long one. And it went through different... So there's a number of ways of thinking about it. Firstly, the idea of putting them on couches or sofas as a kind of plinth of one kind or another came out of this idea that, you know, so much of the time that I'm taking these screenshots, I'm probably sitting on or lying on a couch, you know, kind of rotting away a little bit I kind of watch content on my phone. And so the idea that the phone so often just gets tossed onto a couch, or you kind of go, where's my phone? And you look over and it's on the couch. So there was that idea that felt quite natural. And from there it was like, okay, what kind of couch feels right? And the idea of a modular system is interesting because, you know, phones have this mass production kind of like little lozenge shape, which feels similar to the couches and to the idea of modularity. So there were those ideas. And then there was this thing of like, these couches are super expensive and they're kind of out of reach. And yet the phone in its own way has this modern day everyday luxury to it, where we all have become, to a certain point, I guess, so reliant on them, and they are able to give us so much. And they're reasonably expensive, but we've all just decided that they're necessary. They've become like a necessary luxury. And we all pay the price tag, you know? but there is a juxtaposition of like a high and low brow luxury, which, it's just an interesting interplay. But, you know, like you could also do the idea of the dummy phones on dummy couches or fake couches. And that was something that I looked into, and I found the exact same couches that we use, which are the real ones, were being replicated and sold out of a warehouse in Lower Hutt by a group of people who had redesigned it and had them manufactured in China. I don't know. I thought about that, and I enjoyed in the end the negotiation with Matisse and the idea that they were willing to come on board and work with us, and that there's something about the like inaccessibility of these couches to most people that I think makes them interesting as objects for these phones to sit on.
Yeah, and I also, you did briefly talk about it, but that the install of the phones being very, very scattered and being very kind of bring it back, that idea of a person on the couch and it slips between the sofa or slips on that floor, it kind of has this illusion of a human presence that's been there. Did you kind of want this in the install, that relation to that human presence between them? But then it is also so weird and absurd having so many that it creates a really interesting thing of these phones in this kind of natural habitat of sorts, but with the so many it brings it into that complete like absurd kind of realm.
I enjoy the absurdity of it and the playfulness of it, of having so many phones, because I think hopefully for the viewer, they walk in and are just like, what am I looking at? Like, how are there so many phones here, and what is happening? But beyond that, you know, I've imagined this idea of, because in a way you could view it as like an airport waiting room, departure lounge type setup, where you've got these different couches and you go to those kinds of spaces and everyone is looking at their phone and then they're leaving and then someone else comes and replaces them. Mm. And almost like, imagine if everyone left their phones behind, you know, there's that element, or every time you screenshotted, the phone created a copy and just fell onto the couch. You know, there's things like that I like thinking about. So I think that's where the idea of the many, many phones came from. It was about, one, capturing my watch history. And so automatically over time, there were a lot of phones. And then also just the fun and the playfulness, and then some of these ways in which you can imagine the human within that space. Mm. The couch is made for us, right? And the phone is made for us. And so these two things are working on that scale.
Mm. And I want to talk a little bit more about the relationship and the conversations that is created by having these different kind of, these ready-mades and these objects in that one space, in that space together, speaking to different economies. What kind of conversations do you want it to, I don't know, pull up?
I love the fact that all of them, you know, both the phone and the couch system, have so much symbolic meaning on their own, right? Like, yeah, again, if we think about this idea of the design landscape, if you look at like a logo or a phone, anything that's been designed, it has so much meaning packed into it already. And everyone has a relationship to these things. The phone is so loaded with all of our own understandings of it, our histories with it. And so if you think about it as a ready-made, it comes pre-packaged with heaps of meaning. But, you know, I think you can be lazy with that and it's not interesting because of the fact that it already has all that meaning pre-packaged. And so my job is to be like, oh, there's something interesting here that flips things on its head in some way or another. This phone is a shell. It's engraved. It's been made permanent in a very strange way. Also, I like the idea that potentially people might even initially think that it's a working phone displaying a subtitle, and then you get closer and realize, no, wait a minute, this is like engraved into the phone. So there's all these ways in which I'm playing with a ready-made item to subvert it in some way or to make it do something it's not meant to do. But I like that it comes with all that loaded meaning in the first place. And if you can understand that and then play with it, you can do something hopefully interesting.
Do you have any questions or thoughts that you wish for viewers to kind of bump up against when they enter that space of that work and kind of go through it and engage with it?
I think there's something about the lament that I like that I maybe hope people see, and that's my more serious artist side. And I also just, I hope and enjoy the idea of people just picking subtitles that they like and being like, oh, I love this one. Oh, that's really funny. The playfulness of that and the unexpectedness of the display of just walking in and being like, why am I looking at what I'm looking at and how does this work? And, you know, often I just love that art can do that it does something that nothing else can do, and that means it does weird things or displays things in strange ways. And I like the agency of that. I like just the idea that this work was a thought in my mind and now it exists in the world is quite gratifying and nice. And yeah, I've come to realize that I'm always surprised by what people find in the work I make, whether it is the more research heavy work that comes with a lot of content to delve into, or something like this that is more playful potentially on the surface but also has layers of meaning. I'm always surprised by things that the audience sees that I haven't thought about. And again, I think that's why I like art and why it's powerful, because it can have lives way beyond whatever you first intended it to have.
Yeah, there's always that layer from when you're making it, you're so personal with it, and it's kind of, I think there's always maybe a bit of the work that you can never quite see yourself as the artist. Mm. And it's only once it enters that gallery space and it has that opportunity for that engagement and for viewers to kind of bring their own thoughts and baggage and life into the equation, that the work, I don't know, really has the chance to live out its of life in some capacity.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was Matthew Galloway speaking to me about his current show, Watch History, which is on at SUMA until the 15th of November.
Oh, that's a good art!
We've now got some Julia Jacklin for you, and this is To Perth Before the Border Closes. Enjoy.
Thank you. city held me. I got a feeling I won't do it alone. It's just a feeling, though.
Be a family.
Darling, but is it art?
Hedia Anderson-Mita is an Otorohanga-based artist whose practice depicts the everyday lives of the people of her community, often portraying landscapes or these tender, intimate moments in domestic and communal environments, but also the political and social environment of today that shape contemporary Māori life. In her current solo exhibition, Pa Te Huarahi Ki Te Kāinga, Finding My Way Home, on at Tim Melville Gallery, each painting locates and portrays a side of history and connection within the rohe of Ōtewa, Rangitoto Tuhua, and the surrounding pā of Ngāti Maniapoto and Rere Ahu. Tracing the footprints of her tūpuna, Anderson Meter's inquiry sees her painting the pātuna, the kohatu, the maunga, and the awa that were once sources of sustenance for entire communities, bringing these subjects into light as an avenue to share her knowledge of this area with others. I had a kōrero with Hiria about the show and her overall practice.
Kia ora, my name is Hiria Mariah Anderson, Mita, and I'm from Ōtorohanga, I live there, and I'm a painter, so I've always been into art ever since I was a little kid. So I grew up and ended up in art school at Wānanga Aotearoa, and then went on later on in my life and did my master's at Wycliffe. So it was quite a progression in adulthood into professional arts, but I've always been making.
I want to talk a little bit about the subject of your practice. It tends to focus on painting the everyday lives of your community, as well as these relational nuances and connections between Māori culture and the 21st century, often portraying these tender, intimate moments in domestic and communal environments, but also the political and social environment of today that shape contemporary Māori life. In this current exhibition at Tim Melville Gallery, Pa Te Huarahi Ki Te Kāinga, Finding My Way Home, you've described these new works as a return to the ancestral lands that have shaped who you are. I guess to introduce the show, do you want to start by speaking a little bit to the subject matter of these new paintings and what drew you to creating a series depicting these locations?
Well, that's like a huge, like a seminar on, I suppose, what drew my practice. I think a lot of elements from my childhood come through. I lived with my grandparents and I went with them to a lot of hui and at marae, locally and outside of our district. And so my eyes were captured, you know, all of this in my ears, my senses, the world around me. So that's all I knew growing up. Till about 13, 14. So I lived with them and we had a marae on our front lawn. My grandfather built it with help of others and whānau, and that became our family whare, and it was right outside the house, the main house that we lived in. So I was in and out of playing all around that whare, and my cousins would come over and would play there. And so a lot of that home life informed the work that I do today. And also around painting, I had this strong kind of, traditional style of painting throughout the house. So we had prints and things like that of Vermeer and landscapes and old English landscapes and all that kind of thing in the house. So it was all that kind of thing was my grandparents' sort of vibe at the time. And who else? Salvador Dali. He was in the whare as well. And so I captured the idea around realism through those artworks, and so they're projected into the work that I do as well today. So when I went to Wycliffe and studied, I actually didn't want to do painting. I wanted to do everything else but painting because I didn't know what I was really going to do with it until my supervisor, and this is going back to 2014, 15, 16, I was with Wycliffe, and they actually honed my practice and showed me that I actually was a painter, that I should just don't worry about everything else, that the other mediums that I was looking at and get into painting and really hone my craft there. So I did that, and that's where this study on realism and also in, you know, early sort of Western or English style paintings, European type paintings came into play, and I studied that, and I drew down on that history of Western painting, and then worked through my knowing and understanding of my own culture and history into that. And so that's where these works, and all of my works that I do, no matter what subject matter I'm working on, it stems from. But with this lot of work, and it's been on my mind for a few years now, is that as I get older, I'm like 51 now, and it's sort of like when I turn 50, an intense kind of lens happened in my work, that I need to look at the history of where I live and where my grandparents lived, and in our politics today, post-colonial politics, where Māori are sort of our knowledge of where we live and the history of the expanse of our land, and that it shrunk so much into a little block of land that I needed to go back in time and have a look at our footprint, at our natural footprint of being Māori, and bring those landscapes back into in front of us, in front of our children and ourselves as adults today, to see where we've come from. Yeah, so I've taken a really quite a deep dive into our history.
Mm, that's so beautiful. Yeah, you've spoken so beautifully there about how grounded your upbringing in Ōtorohanga is to your practice, and it's so lovely to hear about how that kind of has influenced and changed in the way it's taken shape in your practice throughout the years, coming up to this exhibition. In terms of process, are you able to talk me through a bit more about your making process as a painter? How do you go from turning your ideas into the final product?
It's a little bit challenging, because when I'm invited to show, you know, in a solo or in a group show, my work depends on what's happening in my life right now. So the oil painter that requires a process, but what I'm doing right now is quite fast in how I have to turn around narratives for my work, but also working in with what I'm currently interested in this moment of time. It's quite demanding, so I have to work fast with slow mediums. Mm. Yeah, being an oil painter.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's not a lot of the time it's not something that I can plan for. If I see something happening, like kids running across a field, you know, that is my exhibition is in a month's time or something, or 2 weeks, or, you know, and I want to include that in my body of work, that's where the challenge arises for me.
I wanted to come back a little bit to your process with this show specifically, and this idea of finding your way back home. It appears that your process in this series was quite rooted in your research into place as well, where through Māori land court records, 19th century field books, maps, archives, oral histories, and the land itself, you've been able to locate these sites of histories and connection. You worded this process really beautifully as a tracing of the footprints of your tupuna. Talk to me a bit about this research aspect behind the works and what that process looked like for you.
So it took the first lot of work in terms of research happened when I just started listening to people talk about what had been going on in Otewa, in the history of Otewa. And some of it relied on what I had learnt as a child listening to my grandparents and my grandfather in particular talk about elements of our history. And I would go out with a rua and a group of like 50 or 60 people on a bus, and he'd go around and talk about the history of, you know, our region. I soaked it in like a sponge, and it really resonated with me. And I must have been in my 20s and 30s where I started to join in on what was happening, and with Granddad and disseminating his history through trips and things like that out for Kaumatua. So I join in. The next thing is when I returned back home and started joining in on committee meetings and things, I saw that a lot of people, there was a disconnect, like there is with all of us, a disconnect with our history and and elements of our history. So I started to think about how can I bring this knowledge back in so that everybody knows what's happened in the past. My uncle, he has spoken to my mother. He was sick and he had said to her, I want Hedia and I to write a book about the history of Wātiwa. And then she told me, and then not long after that, he passed away. So it was then that a little time afterwards that I put my hand up to myself and said, oh, I want to write a book about the history of Wātiwa. And then, bang, after that, all these things started happening. Like information was coming to me like synchronicity, you know, without me even having much effort. And so I started taking elements that were coming to me and started piecing them together and started getting a bigger picture and a bigger picture. I went and I phoned up, I found a local archaeologist that was into looking at Māori past sites and things like that. So I found his number and I rung him up and I said, oh, are you knee deep in mud or can I talk to you? and he goes, oh, you know, no, I'm fine, I can talk. I said, well, yes, I want to know. I've been down to the National Library in Te Kōti. Photos of Te Kōti landmarks are down there and I want to look for something. So that's when I got to meet him. And he was able to show me records that were pertaining to the landmarks that were down Otewa. And the landmarks, I was so surprised, the past sites that they had found, that was the beginning of opening up the history, to my eyes, the history of Otewa. So through the archaeology, I was able to create a Google Earth map and I started putting every landmark that I found in any paperwork, including the archaeology, into this Google Earth map, and it's quite big now. So my document that I work from on Google Earth is quite big. And then I started piecing the puzzles together. From there, when I found matching documentation for one past site, for say, then I started seeing a real picture of the history that happened there. And that's when I found Kūpapa and Ongarahu. And I'm still discovering things today, opening up things today. But what I found that was significant to me is that where Kūpapa Pā is, Rereahu lived, and where Ongarahu is, his son Dinarangi lived. And that's around about the 1500s, 1600s, you know, that those people lived. And I was seeing this information starting to knit together. So I found Ongarahu through the Google Maps and the records. And so I went there on car and I started to stalk the area. And so you can stand up on this hill and look out over to Kūpapa and Ongarahu just behind. And it looked like a past site. And it was, you'd look out and you could see right through to the Kakepuku Maunga behind it, and it's up on a rise, and it's just beautiful, and no wonder people live there. And so I started with that, and then I went around to other places that I know of, and that's how Puke Tarata came about, because I lived there. And yeah, I could go on and on, but you know.
No, it's so beautiful to hear that process and just even a snippet of it. And I think, like, it's amazing how much richness there is within the works and behind an artwork, there's just so much history and meaning behind it, and it's it's so great to get insight into that. For those who do see the show, do you have like a particular intention for how the works are interpreted or engaged with, particularly in this way that you're bringing these sites of rich histories into light?
Well, I have my intentions, but at the end of the day, it's up to the people to be drawn in or not, or to interpret or not. I think the main thing that I want is for this history or kōrero to be out in our public audience and received again, because I know for myself that it's really hard to access records that are in archives and museums, and if it's hard for me to access, then it will be hard for others to access that aren't, that don't have a an access way that I do, in the same way that I do, to museums and things like that. So I've extracted that information out and created this artwork, and I've also added in the Google Earth coordinates that go with the artwork, so people can see where the pāa actually is. So there's no mystery to where, you know, here you painted this, you know, work. It's all there. But also the history can be located as well. So that's important to me.
For sure. That's such a nice detail to the show. Just lastly, accompanying the show, you've written a piece titled The Return Home, Te Hokinga ki Te Kāinga. Do you want to maybe talk about the inclusion of it?
Of course. It's another avenue of receiving knowledge and as poetry. In that poem has got old names that have disappeared with time, names of pātuna, names like Puke Poto, you know, it's not heard of in today's context of land, so I'm looking at reinstating those names back so people can hear them again and know how valuable pātuna were to past sites. And my ancestor, Te Pana Kōmanga, he said in the Māori Land Court minutes, here is a pātuna at Manga Whero, and here is another one at Manga Pōhue, and could you please keep them within this land block? This is when they were slicing up the land blocks and things like that. Could you please keep these two pātuna in with these past sites so they're kept together? I'm not sure if that happened, but it's important to recognise. And so in the end, I hope one day that poem will be translated into a mōtiatia so that those names stay out at Otiwa, but that's for other people to decide, because I cannot, you know, preempt that. That's if the people want it. Yeah, but that's another way of receiving knowledge.
That was artist Hedia Anderson-Mita speaking to me about her current exhibition, Pā Te Huarahi Ki Te Kāinga, Finding My Way Home, on at Tim Melville Gallery. The show is on until the 15th of November.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists. Pull back the cover. Shade. God, it's a raid. Cut out the lights and call the law. Cut out the lights and call the law. Standing over there, the devil's son-in-law. Thank you.
devil's son. Bring on the juice. Bring on the juice. Bring on the juice. Bring on the juice. Make me sweat. Give the drummer some of this funky soul we got here. You don't have to do no soloing, brother. Just keep what you got. Don't turn it loose, because it's a mother. When I count to four, I want everybody to lay out and let the drummer go. And when I count to four, I want you to come back in. It's in my collar. I got the holler. I said it's in my feet. Feels so sweet. It's in my shirt, good God, huh? About to wipe me to death. It's in my shirt, about to wipe me to death. It's in my shirt, I walk the floor. I wanna walk the floor. One, two, three, four, get it. Good God. Ain't it fun?
Colors come out of someone's mouth before.
There's more where that came from.
The Exploding Rainbow Orchestra is back. And if you want to see all the colors of the rainbow in one room erupting in wondrous sonic performance, then tune into 95BFM Breakfast all week, because we've got tickets to give away to the opening night.
The Exploding Rainbow Songbook Volume 4, November 4th, 5th and 6th at Whakamana Cannabis Museum. Tickets available from Mushtix.
Go Cooler Music Store in Newmarket is Aotearoa's newest destination for vintage and pre-loved music gear.
With Go Cooler, you can save money on your music setup without skimping on quality. Plus, students get a 10% discount. Go Cooler have a wide range of sick equipment from Squires, Yamahas, Epiphones, LTDs, and more.
Go Cooler Music is open Wednesday till Sunday, 10 till 4. Find Go Cooler Music on Facebook, spelled G-O-K-U-L-A. Go Cooler Music Store, 378 Broadway, Newmarket.
95. The original originator. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Mixtape was sad. She saw shows with specific themes and thought, who am I? Then one day she realised that she'd been lovingly crafted by her father Sam for a greater purpose, to guide people into their Sunday the right way. She would fulfil her mission, no matter the cost. The Sunday Mixtape. Expect the latest drops, the deepest cuts, and everything in between. The Sunday Mixtape with your host Sam. Sundays 9 till 10 a.m. Right here on 95BFM.
It's the 95BFM Art Guide. On various artists. It's paintings in that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tāmaki Makaurau, as mentioned on the show, Heria Anderson Mita's Pā, Te Huarahi, Te Kāinga, Finding My Way Home is on at Tim Melville Gallery until the 15th of November.
Also mentioned on the show, Matthew Galloway's Watch History opened last night at Suma and is on until the 15th of November.
Echo, an exhibition by Tara Kasabul, Erica Holm and Naroma Riley, opens tonight at Artspace Aotearoa from 6 till 8pm.
And opening tomorrow at Anna Miles Gallery is Adrian Vaughan's Blue Myrtle. So head along to the opening event, which is from 3 to 5 tomorrow.
Louise Bourgeois in Private View is on at Auckland Art Gallery, Toyo Tāmaki, until the 17th of May 2026.
New paintings by Liz Moore and Erica Holmes Eunuch are on at Ivan Anthony until the 8th of November.
Cindy Leong's A Moment's Interlude is on at Public Record until the 26th of October.
Breath Spectrum by Nick Austin is on at Coastal Signs Gallery until the 25th of October.
Gus Fisher Gallery's group exhibition, What We Choose to Remember, as well as Chevron Hassett's Aroha ki te Tangata, is on at Gus Fisher until the 13th of December. Jesus. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kororo mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us on Various Artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us.
Heria Anderson-Mita.
And Matthew Galloway.
Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com or check out our Instagram at 95bfm Various Artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātoa, te rā wiki. Next up is the Land of the Good Groove with Murray or Nigel. We'll see. My name is Sophia.
I'm Maya.
And that was Various Artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.